ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
And we talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature another interview with Charles Horn, author of the book Meat Logic, Why Do We Eat Animals? That's a little later on the show, but first some news.
October was Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and as part of the highly successful campaign, we saw pink everything, from socks to pumpkins to football cleats to hairstyles. And while awareness is critical, November is a perfect month to start focusing on prevention. And as Veg News reports, a new study suggests that eating a plant-based diet is the best option for living cancer-free. New research was released from a cancer study that included more than 164,000 women worldwide. The findings? If you've been diagnosed with breast cancer, a plant-based diet is the best way to lessen the chances of a second occurrence. The study found that a diet of fruit and vegetables, along with maintaining a healthy weight and getting regular exercise, is the optimal defense against future diagnoses. In a statement by the American Institute for Cancer Research, Associate Director for Nutrition Programs Alice Bender said, "We know there are many reasons for women to eat a plant-based diet and be active, both for cancer prevention and overall health. So start your plant-based diet today."
An estimated 80% of all antibiotics in the U.S. are given to livestock, which has caused antibiotic-resistant pathogens. A new study on antibiotics just published by researchers from Stanford University School of Medicine might introduce a whole new concern to the equation. Mice given antibiotics to treat salmonella infections have been found to grow sicker and start shedding more pathogens afterwards. In fact, they begin to shed the same levels of bacteria as so-called super spreaders, the small minority of infected mice in the population who exhibit no signs of illness but spread large amounts of bacteria. Dr. Denise Monack, the study's senior author, said, "If this holds true for livestock as well, and I think it will, it would have obvious public health implications. We need to think about the possibility that we're not only selecting for antibiotic-resistant microbes, but also impairing the health of our livestock and increasing the spread of contagious pathogens among them and us. Antibiotics are given to livestock to make them grow faster and prevent sickness from the filthy, cramped conditions on factory farms. The amount of antibiotics sold for use in livestock rose substantially in recent years, according to the Food and Drug Administration, a pattern that experts said was troubling given the efforts to battle antibiotic resistance in humans. In an annual report published earlier this month, the FDA said the amount of antibiotics sold to farmers and ranchers for use in animals raised for meat grew by 16% from 2009 to 2012. The National Chicken Council, an industry group which exists to promote chicken products, said in a statement that the sale of antibiotics did not necessarily correlate with antibiotic-resistant trends, a statement not supported by any facts from the real world. Science has shown that the widespread use of antibiotics in livestock causes antibiotic resistance, which means that critical antibiotics are no longer effective in treating infections in people. A couple of weeks ago, the PBS show Frontline aired a show entitled "The Trouble with Antibiotics," and the National Pork Board responded with a media tactic known as paid search engine optimization, which causes a specific website to show up higher in a search engine's results for particular search terms. The National Pork Board links searches for the terms PBS Frontline and antibiotics to the website of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, where people can read propaganda about how safe our food supply is. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has expressed concern over the growing problem, but has done little to solve it. Last year, the FDA issued a voluntary guideline for farmers and ranchers that they should no longer use antibiotics for promoting fast growth in livestock. But the guideline left open a large loophole. Producers can simply say that they are using the drugs to keep their animals from getting sick, not to make them grow faster.
Associated Press reports that in Maine, a hunter can shoot a bear while it's nose deep in a barrel of donuts after it's been chased up a tree with dogs or when it's snared in a cable trap. But that could change in days, and hunters and animal rights advocates around the country are watching. Bears are hunted in 32 states, but Maine has the most permissive rules. It's the only one that allows hunters to use three methods, baits, dogs, and traps, decried by animal rights groups and targeted by a November ballot proposal that would ban them all. National hunting groups oppose the ban because they believe it could set a precedent that prompts other states to try to roll back hunting rights. Some animal rights activists see it as a dress rehearsal for referendums in other states that allow hunting methods they perceive as cruel. The referendum has prompted a spirited fight within the state, where proponents of the ban say the food habituates bears to humans, which can lead to dangerous encounters. They also decry the three methods as unsportsmanlike. But opponents say the methods are necessary to control Maine's growing bear population, which is up about 30% from 10 years ago. State wildlife biologists oppose the ban and have campaigned against it. Maine Wildlife Division Director Judy Camoso said that the passage of the ban would mean a larger bear population that would create more competition for resources, meaning more bears starve and range into residential settings in search of food. Using bait, typically sugary human food such as donuts, is by far the most common method of bear hunting and accounts for about four-fifths of the hunt and is the most debated of the three methods. Supporters of the proposal say the use of bait has actually abetted the state's growing bear population, dumping thousands of pounds of human food into the woods. One often-cited estimate is it's about 7 million pounds per year, has created a well-fed bear population that reproduces more frequently. They say it's why nuisance bear encounters have increased about 25% since a decade ago. 12 states allow bear baiting with different degrees of restrictions, and of those, Maine, Alaska, Idaho, Utah, Michigan, Wisconsin, and New Hampshire also allow hunting with dogs or hounding. 11 other states allow hounding but not baiting. Let's hope these legislative measures place heavier restrictions on hunting.
Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature another conversation with Charles Horn, author of the book Meat Logic: Why Do We Eat Animals? That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now, once again, on ACT Radio, Charles Horn. Thanks for being with us again, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
Last time we talked about some of the rationalizations people use for eating meat and how, if they were to examine them, they would see the faulty logic that's being used. And so there was a lot we didn't get to, and we hope to get to this time.
Yeah, and so in your book, Meat Logic, you put forward a lot of the common arguments that people make or try to make against why they continue to eat meat and other animal products. So why don't we start out with talking about one of the common ones that we often hear. What if humans needed to eat animals to stay healthy? I mean, you hear that a lot, that, you know, well, I was vegetarian for a while, but I got sick, and the doctor said I had to eat meat.
Yeah, I need those omega-3s from salmon.
Right, right. That was actually something that I specifically wanted to include in the book, because if you remember, I was talking about last time, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was I was just watching all of these Facebook arguments, and people would have the same types of arguments. And one of the things that I saw is that, for example, on this health issue, is that one side would say, oh, it's not healthy, you know, you have to eat animals to be healthy. And then the other side, you know, would be saying, no, that's not true, and here are all these medical bodies that say otherwise. And if the other side isn't believing what you're saying, then you're sort of at an impasse at that point.
Well, they're not hearing us.
Yeah, exactly, or not believing. And so I specifically wanted to address those types of situations where, like, I didn't want to just say, okay, hey, these are the medical bodies that say otherwise. I mean, it actually is healthy, and there are plenty of medical bodies. But I wanted to address the impasse there, and for someone who really believes that you need to eat animals. And so I wanted to cover this hypothetical. What if it actually were hypothetically true that we needed to eat animals to be healthy? What would that mean, morally speaking? How would we have to act? And so I wanted to show them that even if that were true, the way that they're currently acting doesn't follow from that. So they have to change regardless. And so I'm hoping that basically if they realize that, then that kind of pushes them out of their status quo, which is sort of where they're at. And since they've got to make a change anyway, maybe they'd be willing to, you know, make the bigger change of veganism.
And you know what I think is neat too is I mean, there's almost really the argument that we actually need people to go vegan to survive as a species. I mean, we're looking at 7 billion people, 8 billion people, 9 billion people, and we're raising all, you know, clearing forests and raising all this grain and corn just to basically be fed to cows so that they can make, you know, a small portion of that food in total to feed one person. We have people starving to death all around the world. And it's an interesting that people take it, that they need it to live in their daily lives. But as globally as a species, it seems like we really have to make an opposite argument.
Yeah, absolutely. From the environment point of view, there are actually people who, a number of environmentalists who don't care about animals, but they're vegan for environmental reasons.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying is actually very interesting because we should be going towards veganism. There's UN reports that are saying that we need to, and, you know, climate change, it's all related. But yet, you know, some people think that the world would starve if people stopped eating meat.
We're not a very proactive species. We tend to react. So it might be that we need a natural disaster like climate change to finally open people up to this idea. You would think that the argument that we'd need meat to stay healthy would disappear in a few years when lab meat finally comes along. But people, you know, find that idea disgusting and somehow find the idea of a slaughterhouse acceptable.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I know. I mean, at that point, we're getting into, like, psychology, and like, I'm as dumbfounded as, as you are there.
Well, and then also this thing, there's so many cultures on the planet that traditionally didn't eat meat, and they have survived for centuries.
Right. But there's a McDonald's there now.
Well, but, I mean, that's the thing that always surprises me, too, with this thing that we have to eat meat. And you're like, well, there's, like, the Jains in India. There's so many religious sects that don't eat meat, and there's so many people that are in poverty that don't eat meat just because of lack of money. But, I mean, still they're surviving for centuries without meat. So I just don't – I don't understand. Is our mind scope so narrow that we don't think about all these other people in the world that haven't eaten meat traditionally for centuries?
The narrative basically is flipped because – we have to basically buy into this notion that eating meat and animals is the right thing to do. It seems like our thinking is so off because of that. Everything gets turned around to fit into that narrative.
Okay, so who's perpetuating this narrative?
Well, I think it's self-perpetuating in some sense, and also there's society perpetuates that. You know, the meat and dairy industry is a big industry, and government is involved. If you look at TV commercials, for example, there are a million commercials every day for fast food. And meanwhile, if you say something about veganism, you're going to be told that you're pushing your views down someone else's throat.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
The views are actually being pushed on us every day.
Yeah, yeah. I just saw that McDonald's is coming out with sustainable beef now.
Oh, man.
yeah, that's like it's showing a positive sense that all of the arguments for eating animals is, you know, it really was at the logical level, it's a house of cards, and it's falling. And so one thing is to kind of hang on to it is the sustainability or...
Yeah, grasp onto humane meat or something.
Yeah, humane, exactly, those kind of notions.
Well, which is funny because when you think about the word humane or humanity, it, you know, it's supposed to strike a chord in our society as really a noble quality or, you know, a trait that's great about us. And it's funny that they turn around and use a word like humane and then follow it by meat.
I know. It's like those two words just do not go together. Humane killing, you know,
yeah.
it makes no sense. So it's kind of frustrating when people kind of want to hang on to that.
And the propaganda that we see every day on television, the products are sold to us by happy cows and dancing pigs, and it's like theater of the absurd.
Yes, it's craziness. I mean, it really is. It's just this total, you know, flip of the script. You know, rather than animals are individuals in their own right and want to live, which is clearly the case, we've turned it into where they want to kill themselves for you.
Yes. There's another question, or well, comment that I often see that just makes me think, are these people really believing what they're saying when they say things like, carrots scream when you pulled them out of the ground, and don't plants have feelings too?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't imagine that they feel that way themselves, because, you know, if you were to then ask them, do you do anything to stop the... You know,
suffering.
The suffering of plants, they couldn't care, you know, less. So I think it's just a way to, you know, dismiss, you know. It makes, again, the plant thing just makes no sense.
Well, it's pretty obvious that plants are more complicated than we realize, that they do have certain methods of communication through chemical means, but a lot of this dates back more than 50 years to some experiments done by one guy with a lie detector on a plant, published in the book The Secret Lives of Plants, where he tried to demonstrate that plants felt pain. But those experiments were never replicated.
Yeah, exactly. There's no credible scientist who believes that plants are sentient. You know, they may be doing these experiments to show these biological, you know...
Communications?
Yeah, or you know, just how they interact with stimuli.
Yeah.
But there's no scientist who actually says that plants are sentient. And I think the notion of sentience is something that that most people don't understand or haven't thought about. So when they are talking about plants, they're like saying, well, plants are biologically alive too, and so aren't we killing them, and isn't that the same thing? But they don't realize that, you know, there's the notion of sentience. You know, just like we have our own conscious wills and feel pleasure and pain and all that, we're individuals. It's the same thing with an animal, and that's different, that's categorically different than plants and bacteria, you know, and so on. So there's a difference between biological life and sentient life.
You know, but there are fruitarians, and I often find myself grieving a little bit when I have to pull weeds out of my garden.
That's the other thing that's interesting, is that even if in the future, let's say we find out, even though all evidence currently points to it not being the case, but let's say in the future we do find out that plants are sentient.
Yeah.
Well, then it turns out you'd still want to be vegan, because it takes way more plants to feed ourselves through eating the plants, through eating animals, because the animals had to eat a lot of plants.
Right. And so you're killing much, much more plant life.
Yeah. So you're killing much more plant life, and then you're killing the animal, which is much more sentient. So it just makes no sense on that level as well.
And you know, I'm curious, too, your thoughts on, I think there's a lot of people in many aspects of our daily life that say, my choices don't make an impact. I can't make a difference. I can't save the world.
Yeah,
so
there's
I'm
so
just
much, yeah.
So I'm just going to keep on doing what I'm going to do. And what do you think is a good response to that?
Well, I think basically you can point to things in history where people thought the same way. You know, like I'm sure people thought the same way in terms of human slavery.
Yeah.
You know, this was always this way. You know, it'll never change.
And the guy sitting next to Rosa Parks on the bus who said, just sit down.
Yeah, exactly. Things do change when enough people decide that it's time to change them, you know? And I think that's definitely the main answer. But in terms of animals, it's also the case where your diminished purchasing of them together with other people's diminished purchasing is going to make a difference. It's that many less animals that were bred.
So now we're coming to the notion of a tipping point where it looks like, you know, vegans have the majority view, which might be a little ways down the road, I guess.
Yeah, since we're only 2% right now.
We were only 1% a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it actually can happen very quickly. I mean, it has the potential. I'm not saying it will, but I think that there are ideas that get spread across. You know, basically their time has come and it gets spread across. And then the more people that recognize it, the easier it is spread across to the next. And so potentially it could be very, very quick.
Thanks to Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah. We are at a time where that's the case. You know, something can really spread. So that's the hope. Certainly if you asked, looked at, you know, 10 or 20 years ago or whatever, you know, people's views on gay marriage versus today, that happened really quickly.
Yeah, that happened really quickly. That's true. Let's see if we can get some fire under the vegan movement, get to the tipping point. Like Greg said, you know, often you're right. There is a point where the change occurs very fast, and hopefully we're getting closer and closer with books like yours and all kinds of informative cookbooks. I mean, the amount of products available now that are vegan is just like so great compared to just even a few years ago.
Yeah, that's true. And it all goes together because it just makes things easier, and the more you don't even have to think about it, the easier it is to do, and that's important, I think, for mass involvement.
Some of the products are a little too much like animals, like I can't eat that egg thing. What, a yeg or whatever?
Yeah.
Oh, it tastes too much like eggs.
Egg.
They put a little too much sulfur in there. Well, that getting to the taste thing, I mean, that's one of the chapters in your book. It's called Bacon.
And
this, this is an argument that's often made. Like, I would be vegan except for I love bacon or I love cheese, and there's just no way I can, you know, forego my pleasure of eating bacon and cheese. So what do you say to those people?
You would hope that they'd realize what they're saying there, but, I mean,
they don't.
They don't. I know, but, you know, it's like, so, again, you kind of have to point to history, you know, sometimes, and show them that in terms of thought process, there's not much difference in saying that than saying, well, you know, women shouldn't be in the workplace because who's going to make my dinner?
Right.
You know,
I like women to make my dinner, therefore.
Yeah, exactly. You're worried about your pleasure, and you don't care about the effect on the victim. You know, it's just a non-starting argument.
I know, but sometimes it's hard to say anything back to someone that says that to you because, you know, you don't want to be like the angry vegan or the whiny vegan. But sometimes I just say, I really don't know anybody that went vegetarian or vegan because they hated the taste of bacon and cheese.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know,
great.
It goes beyond your taste buds, right?
Yeah. And taste buds can be changed. And also, as we kind of just touched upon, the vegan, you know, world is exploding, and there are so many products that mimic their tastes, and, you know, there are some products that even fool meat-eating food critics.
That's
yeah.
true.
I just got back from Portland, and I bought a vegan bacon grease for the first time. So apparently there is everything.
Yeah,
everything. I never thought I'd see that.
At some point, you've got to accept that it's the right thing to do, and then explore. Like, I found, you know, even the difference between being a vegetarian, which I was for many years, and then when I went vegan, just that change in the box that I put myself in, my palate actually didn't diminish. It expanded as going vegan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most of us find that, yeah.
Because you give yourself permission at that point to try all these new things. And you realize that, hey, you know, okay, I don't like that one, but this one's fantastic. Why wasn't I eating this my whole life?
And yet they think that we vegans have such a limited variety of foods to choose from. Couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Hey. They're the ones that are limiting themselves.
Right.
Yeah, you realize you had been eating at Jack in the Box or McDonald's twice a week, and you know your diet really wasn't that extensive,
and the taste wasn't that great.
No, that's for sure.
I think some of the most powerful activism is just taking somebody, forcing them to a vegan restaurant, you know, a good vegan restaurant, and just like, you know.
And they're popping up all over the place. Yeah. We just had a restaurant hopper here at Dragonfly Wine Bistro and Sushi, and I'm telling you that vegan food was delicious. The rolls and all the different items that the chef prepared, I don't think anybody would have complained about eating that meal. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Places all over the country are becoming, you know, more advanced in having vegan options. 30 years ago when I moved to El Paso, I couldn't get, you know, vegan food. But now there's so many places that I don't even haven't been to all of them yet.
Yeah, no, it's a very exciting, growing time, and it's all a positive, you know, thing, because it's pointing to the fact that people are more open and they are changing. So, yeah, it gives me hope.
They're using logic now in their food choices.
at least moving towards it, whether they're like some people are cutting down or whatever. I mean, logically, you know, we should be vegan. That's the logical case.
Yeah.
And so individually, it takes some people longer to get there. But, you know, for me, what's important is the first initial step has to be that you recognize that logically it makes no sense. And logically, animals need to be liberated. They should not be our property. They should not be our slaves. That should be the first recognition. And if that is really accepted, then we're on the right path.
Uh-huh. The rest is easy.
Right.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Charles Horn, author of Meat Logic, Why Do We Eat Animals? Thanks for being with us again, Charles. And if you'll tell our listeners where they can find your book.
Sure. You can find it on Amazon. Just look up Meat Logic. And there's a paperback version and a Kindle version.
Keep up the good work. And it's great talking with you, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
Thanksgiving is just around the corner. You can find tons of vegan Thanksgiving recipes at CompassionateHolidays.com and shop for animal-friendly products like Field Roast, Gardein, and Tofurky at stores like Target, Sierra Vista Natural Market, and Sprouts.
The Vegetarian Society of El Paso has its annual Compassionate Thanksgiving Dinner on November the 15th at the Sunland Park Holiday Inn. You can find more information about this dinner and make reservations at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. Until next time, I'm Liz Walsh.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.